This summer, wildfires have raged throughout the Southwest. There have been record-breaking fires in Arizona and New Mexico, and throughout the country so far, over 5,800,000 acres have burned. For this week's Please Explain, Ken Frederick and Tom Romanello, the Bureau of Land Management Fire Specialists at the National Interagency Fire Center in Boise, Idaho, join us to talk about how wildfires start and spread, how they behave, and how they're contained and extinguished. And we thank you both for being on our show today.
It's a pleasure, Leonard.
And we also invite our listeners to call us at 646-829-3985 to ask any questions they have about fires, or they can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. So let's begin with you, Ken. How do most wildfires get started?
Well, statistically, most fires are started by people, and that's usually carelessness, escape campfires, or debris burning. Sometimes it's an ATV or a motorcycle without an adequate spark arrestor, but statistically, all around 80 to 90% of wildfires are started by people.
And how do you determine the cause?
We have people who are trained to investigate fires, and basically they track a fire backwards to its point of origin, and then they get down on their hands and knees and use a magnifying glass, and as best they can, they determine what started the fire. It's not an exact science, but most of the time we can tell whether the fire is human-caused or not, and often we can figure out what caused it.
What are the telltale signs of lightning?
Well, first we know when lightning is in an area because we can observe weather remotely. We have technology that enables us to pinpoint the lightning strikes, where they hit by latitude and longitude, and we can actually tell the kind of charge that the lightning has. So positively charged strikes are hotter, so they do tend to start more fires. But when the firefighters get out there, usually they're going to find a tree that's been hit by a bolt of lightning. The tree will usually have a furrow plowed out of the bark right down to the ground, or branches laying around here and there, so it's pretty obvious.
Tom, are there specific fire seasons?
What do you mean by that question, Leonard, specific fire season?
Well, we tend to not see them in the wintertime, although there are parts of the country where it's warm all year round and where there's relatively little rainfall. Why now?
Well, in the West, typically Southwest is the first part of the Western United States to kind of come into fire season. Usually by February or March, the Southwest has started to cure out. The fuels are getting dry, and fire seasons tend to start earlier there and then kind of progress northward as the season goes on. Usually by late June on into July, the season has moved up kind of into the Great Basin states of the western U.S., and then on up into the northern Rockies later in July and August. And typically by late September, things are cooling down here in the West. Across the southern states, it's an earlier fire season as well, although this year has been extremely dry from Texas on through all the southern states on into Georgia and Florida. And the season there would typically be winding down this time of year because of monsoonal moisture that comes up out of the Gulf, but we're not seeing an end to that season yet, so that's kind of in a nutshell.
Well, we don't see many of them in our area. Is that because we get more rain here than in those other parts of the country?
Yeah, typically so.
Although we have had fires in the pinelands in New Jersey in the past.
Yeah, absolutely. It depends on your weather patterns and fuel types, those sorts of things. You see a lot more fire activity in the western United States because the summers tend to be very long and very dry and tend to dry out the fuels. And a lot of the ecosystems in the western U.S. are fire adapted and tend to depend on fire. So there is a lot more fire activity.
They depend on fire, Ken? How does that work?
Well, there are some species of conifer trees that actually need fire to break open their cones and scatter the new seeds out on the ground. Also,
so they die for their young, in effect?
Well, the cones are laying there on the forest floor. they may lay there 10 years, 100 years, or longer before a fire that's hot enough comes through. That fire will kill the overstory. And I'm thinking of lodgepole pine. But there's a ready-made seed source right there on the ground, and fire opens the cones. And within a few years, you'll have numerous seedlings growing.
Well, the Southwest has been experiencing a serious drought over the past few years. Is that why we've been seeing so many fires this year?
It's a combination of drought, and this past winter we had a La Nina weather pattern, which denied the normal rain and snow that the Southwest would get over a winter. It sent it up here in the north, actually. But dry fuels, and then we've had a hot, windy spring and summer. And unfortunately, when you get those conditions and a fire starts, it usually means trouble for firefighters.
Is the number of acres burned so far in 2011 above average?
Yes, we're significantly above average for this date. We're probably about 140% of the 10-year average. 10-year average was skewed a little bit because in the mid-2000s, we had several years that were horrendous fire years. 2006, we burned almost 10 million acres in the United States, which for the modern era is a record.
Well, if I remember correctly, there usually are fires in the Los Angeles area around this time of year, but that doesn't seem to have happened.
You know, the fires around Los Angeles and San Diego typically occur later in the summer, even into the fall, and those fires are driven by a wind pattern that's typical of Southern California. So we'll have our fingers crossed when we hit November and hope that they don't get a bad fire season.
When wildfires occur near or even in urban areas, I'm assuming they're more challenging to contain.
They can be because the mission isn't just attack the head of the fire, the hottest part. The mission becomes protecting homes. Our priorities are protect life, protect property, and then protect natural resources. So that's very common with all the federal and state and local fire agencies. So sometimes it's necessary to divert the resources from attacking the fire and do a defensive action for a few hours or a few days before we can marshal enough resources to go after the fire.
Tom, what are ways that people can do to – what are the things they can do to protect their homes if there's a nearby fire?
Well, we like to have homeowners engage long before the smoke's in the air, so to speak, to maybe cooperate with their local fire protection agencies to understand what types of actions they can take around their homes to make them a little more fireproof for when the fire is there, clearing brush away from the home, clearing trees and debris back away from the home. So providing defensible space, as we call it.
What about tile roofs? Is that a good idea?
Tile roof is a very good idea. Yeah, the cedar shake roof is one you would want to stay away from in a fire-prone area.
So are people building more fireproof houses in areas like Southern California?
Yes, they are, and we're seeing communities become more fire-wise, as we call it in the business, understanding what needs to be done ahead of time to protect their homes and using materials that are less flammable and those sorts of things.
How do you know when it's time to order an evacuation of an area? Is there a certain tipping point?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting question, and the technical term is a trigger point that we use in the business. An incident commander is the individual that's in charge on the ground for command and control when there is a fire approaching, say, a subdivision or some homes. And the incident commander will be working with the folks on the fire to determine what those trigger points are, working with the other agencies, the sheriffs, law enforcement, folks that are responsible for evacuation. And when the fire reaches those trigger points, then an evacuation order would be put into place if it was determined there would be a threat.
Is it a good idea for people to leave their sprinklers on after they go?
Typically not, I guess it would kind of depend on the area and if the available water system could support that sort of thing. But the best advice is to have cleared away that debris before that point is reached.
We're talking about the fire season, forest fires and the like, with Tom Romanello and Ken Frederick, Bureau of Land Management fire specialists at the National Interagency Fire Center, on today's Please Explain. Ken, what can be done to reduce the risk of fire in dry conditions? Are some of the state and national forests banning camping in dry areas this year?
They do. When fire danger reaches certain levels, often the local jurisdiction, the land manager, will make the decision to enact certain levels of restriction, and they're graded. The most severe one is a closure of the land area, like a national forest or a national park. We do see that occasionally. We've seen that in the Southwest this year. There's been several national forests that basically, you know, closed the gates and said, "We're sorry, folks, but it's the conditions are too dangerous to allow camping and visitation right now." One of the things that agencies do is use a tool we call prescribed fire. Basically, that consists of introducing a low-intensity fire on the landscape. It burns up hazardous fuels. It does nutrient cycling. It actually helps wildlife habitat. And the main thing, though, is it makes firefighters feel a lot more confident when we get a wildfire that they can attack that fire and handle it easily, because it won't get to the kinds of high intensity that make a fire really dangerous to approach.
But I wonder why so many of these fires are man-made. People do put out their campfires. Are they doing something wrong?
Well, you know, I was on a fire one time where some campers dumped a bucket of ice on their fire and left. And they assumed that the ice would melt and it produce water and that put the fire out. The problem is the ice wasn't spread thoroughly around the fire. So that was a case of somebody intending to do the right thing, but they just didn't go far enough. So we say use water, dump water on the fire, then take a shovel or a stick and stir it up, and then kind of place your hand over that the ring of the, you know, the rock ring or the fire pit, and don't touch it, but just feel very close, and you'll usually feel heat. And if you feel any more heat, then repeat the process. But make sure that if you're going to leave for any amount of time and it's dry and windy, that you put that fire out. So it comes down to people being cognizant and being careful.
Tom, the Wallow Fire in eastern Arizona burned 469,000 acres. It's the biggest fire in that state's history. Why was it so aggressive and hard to contain?
Leonard, actually, the Wallow burned 538,000.
So more.
The old record was the Rodeo Chetiskay Fire in 2002, and it burned 469,000 acres, and that was an eye-opener. I was on that fire, and it's hard to believe, but it actually was eclipsed by the Wallow Fire.
But what happened here? Do we know what got it started and why it was so aggressive and hard to contain?
That was a human-caused fire. It was started, we don't know who or the exact circumstances, but it was not a lightning fire. What happened, it was just very windy, and the fire found a huge landscape of continuous fuel that was dry and ready to burn. And think of the equation that we have to face when we try to attack a large fire. It's growing by the minute, and you have to get literally, in some cases, thousands of firefighters, hundreds of engines, dozens of aircraft. You've got to get all of those on the site and organized and working together and working safely. So sometimes fires get such a head start that they get big before we can do much about them.
My guests on today's Please Explain are Ken Frederick and Tom Romanello, Bureau of Land Management Fire Specialists at the National Interagency Fire Center in Boise, Idaho. And we are taking your calls at 646-829-3985, or you can leave a question about fires, a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. We'll take a little break and come back with more. We're back with today's Please Explain, a look at forest fires. This is forest fire season. And my guests are Ken Frederick and Tom Romanello, Bureau of Land Management Fire Specialists at the National Interagency Fire Center in Boise, Idaho. And we are taking your calls at 646-829-3985, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Tom, is Boise an area that gets hit a lot by forest fires?
Yes, Leonard. Actually, Boise does get a lot of forest fires. The landscape here in Boise is a desert area, but it also abuts the Rocky Mountains, so we have a range land type of landscape that supports early fires earlier in the season, a lot of grass and brush type fuels. And then as the season progresses, the higher country up on the National Forest and the higher mountains tends to dry out and support a later season, usually well into September or October. So very, very fire-prone area.
One of the ongoing fires, the Las Conchas fire that's burning near Los Alamos and the Santa Clara Pueblo in New Mexico, spread to nearly 50,000 acres within 24 hours. Is that especially fast?
Well, it is a very fast-moving fire, but certainly not unheard of. When the right conditions of drought, very dry fuels, hot, windy conditions come into alignment, it's not unusual to see that type of fire spread.
Although it partially overlapped an area that burned 10 years ago, if a fire already claimed an awful lot of trees 10 years ago, is that area less likely to be affected?
Well, yes, it is, and that depends somewhat on the fuel types in those areas. And the fuel type that that particular fire is burning in, yes, those areas do, the areas that had previously burned, do provide a fire break that we use a lot of times in our strategies and tactics. When we fight a fire, we will a lot of times try to kind of steer it towards those areas that had previously burned. Other fuel types, say you're in the southern or southeastern United States in southern rough type fuel type, it tends to grow back so quickly that a fire that occurred 10 years ago or even 5 years ago probably would not provide much of a break. So it is somewhat dependent on fuel types in the area.
Tom, you mentioned earlier that in some cases fires are started to get rid of brush and other things that might cause worse forest fires under other circumstances. But aren't some forest fires just allowed to go out on their own?
Yes, they are, Leonard, actually, depending on the location of the fire. Fire management plans, as we call them, every burnable acre within the United States that is managed by the federal government is required to have a fire management plan. Fire management plans allow for some fires to burn for resource benefit. Typically, those are in wilderness-type areas, in areas where there is no immediate population or structures. So, yes, a lot of those areas, the fire is allowed to burn. It's monitored, and if it looks like the fire would become a threat, then action would be taken on it.
Well, Ken, you can't just attach a hose up to a fire hydrant to fight these things. Is it all done by air?
We have a number of different ways. Tom is a former smoke jumper. He could probably talk better about that than I can, but we have a bag of tricks we use to fight remote fires.
Tom, what did you do?
Well, I've done a variety of different jobs in the fire business. One of them, as Ken mentioned, was smoke jumping, and smoke jumpers are a tool just like the other fire resources that we utilize for fire control. The smoke jumper mission is to provide a quick response to remote wildfires that are otherwise inaccessible by road or other avenues. So a smoke jumper may get dispatched to a fire deep in a wilderness somewhere, be able to arrive over the fire quickly with a fixed-wing aircraft and parachute into the fire or very nearby and take quick action on the fire and help hold it in check until additional reinforcements can get there. So that's typically the smoke jumper mission, although they do provide a lot of other fire management-type services.
Paula from California has written in, and she asks, did the terrible fires in Australia change U.S. firefighting and evacuation practices? It seems to be a completely different level of fire that than anyone had experienced and forced Australia to change its own forest fire practices.
That really didn't change a lot of what we do, but it did make us reexamine our ways we think about evacuating. There's a a program, kind of an approach called Ready, Set, Go that we're starting to see in various parts of the country. And what that means is think about what you would do if your home was threatened by fire. Be ready. You know, a lot of people lose precious moments when the fire really is a threat because they don't know what to take. They don't know what to do. They don't know how to leave the house. What condition? Do you leave lights on? Do you leave the doors open or locked? What do you do with your pets? Things like that. So we do have to think about that. And the fires in Australia a couple of years ago really underscored the importance of being ready.
And what do you do? Do you leave the doors open or do you close them?
Leave them unlocked. Leave your lights on, the porch light or the exterior lights. That way firefighters will know if the home has electricity. More important, though, is, as Tom mentioned a few minutes ago, you have to create defensible space. You've got to allow firefighters to have a chance to defend your home if you live in an area dominated by wildland fuels. So it's not complicated. Thinning some of the trees and brush, get the leaves and pine needles out of your gutters and out of the valleys of your home's roof. Make sure that if you have a wooden deck, you don't have anything burnable underneath it. Don't store firewood stacked right next to your house. And have a green zone around your house, either a lawn or fire-resistant shrubs and vegetation. So it's not hard to do, but people do have to keep up on it and make sure that they're maintaining what they've done to have defensible space around their home.
Well, those are homeowners, but Steve from Hoboken asks, should fallen trees and forests be removed since they could contribute fuel to forest fires? And he is thinking specifically about areas like Albany and upstate New York.
Yeah, often it's impractical to go out across an entire forest. A lot of the forests in the western United States are millions of acres in size. And state forests are tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of acres. So the scale of that kind of work is not feasible to undertake. Plus, downed trees are in the process of decomposing, and that's just part of the forest ecosystem. Now, sometimes we would have a prescribed fire intended to burn some of those pieces of wood and kinds of fuels out there, but we're really more concerned with grasses, brush, and finer kinds of sticks and limbs and things, because those contribute to the spread of a fire more than logs do.
We're talking to Ken Frederick and Tom Romanello, Bureau of Land Management Fire Specialists at the National Interagency Fire Center in Boise, Idaho, about forest fires. For today's Please Explain, this is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate, and we invite your calls at 646-829-3985, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Tom, what is dropped on these fires? Sometimes fire retardant is dropped from planes. Is that just water, or what is it made of?
Well, it is made of water and a chemical mixture that provides a sort of a retardant to a fire, and also it impedes the evaporation of the water. If you just put straight water on a fire on a very hot, windy day, it would evaporate very quickly. In some instances, we use straight water if there's environmental concerns, such as maybe a nearby river. But the retardant allows you to coat the fuels and prevent the evaporation, and works very effectively.
Would rain put out a forest fire?
That depends on the types of fuels that the fire is burning in. If it's burning in a light grass-type fuel, rain could very easily put out a fire, especially a significant amount of rain. But in the heavier fuels, timber, or again in the southern rough-type fuels found in the southeastern United States, in the Alaska fuels, a very large amount of rain will typically not put those fires out. They'll burn. The fuel bed is so deep and so much fuel and biomass that it really takes a significant amount of rain to knock those types of fires down. And they will rekindle sometimes days or weeks later when the weather dries back out.
Because they're smoldering.
Correct.
Ken, we hear about fires being 10% contained or 80% contained. Does that mean that much has actually been extinguished?
Containment is an expression of the incident commander's comfort that that they've caught the fire. So most incident commanders that I've seen tend to be conservative, that they're not going to say we've got it 50 or 75% contained if they understand they're still in a fight with that fire and it still could get away. So containment means we think that we've stopped it from spreading. It, when it's contained, it's not out yet, but 100% containment generally means we believe we've stopped this fire.
But you have to develop a strategy, don't you, for fighting the fire? Is each one different? How do you figure out a fire's behavior?
I'll defer to Tom on that one.
Yes, that is a very good question, Leonard. Partially that depends on the fire management planning that we spoke about earlier. What types of actions are we going to take on a fire if it starts in this area? If it's a wilderness fire, maybe we're going to allow it to burn. If it's a fire that's close to an urban center, we're going to be very aggressive about attacking the fire. It starts with the fire management plan as to what types of actions will be taken, and then from there, fuels, how dry they are, what the fire behavior is at the time, will dictate what the strategy is. If we arrive at a fire and the fire is very large and is rolling across the landscape, we're going to have to adjust our tactics and strategies based on that type of fire behavior and probably start towards the rear of the fire and work our way around it. If it's a smaller fire, we may be able to just go directly in there and even to the hottest part of the fire and attack it directly. So the strategy and tactics are developed based on kind of a myriad of things.
And don't you sometimes start fires to stop fires?
Yes, we do, which is called a back burn or a burnout. Typically, we will get out in advance of the fire and utilize a lot of times maybe an existing road system or build fire lines away from the main fire. And once those lines are in place or we've identified a road system that we can utilize, then we'll bring in crews to actually burn out from those lines and sort of rob the main fire of additional fuel.
Ken, what are the effects of wildfires after they're put out? Isn't erosion and flooding sometimes a problem?
And a highly intense fire will burn away the vegetation that's holding the soil in place, especially on steeper pieces of country. So that is a concern, and we would look at what we need to do to try to prevent worse problems from happening. So if the slopes are very steep, we'll see if we have the window of opportunity and the manpower to build small biodegradable terraces. We'll go into gullies and canyons and build dams. Basically, we take burned trees, cut them down, and use those to make these little dams. And the purpose is to slow the movement of water. We can't stop all erosion. We just don't have the ability to do that, but we can certainly mitigate the effects and slow things down and protect the forest from suffering even worse after a big fire.
But your answer suggests that in many fires, some trees and plants survive. We have any idea why this one and not that one?
No, sometimes the fire will reduce its intensity. Either the wind dies down or the fire runs into maybe a rock outcropping and it loses some of its intensity. Or when night falls, humidities tend to go up because the air mass cools down. And when the air cools down and the relative humidity in the air increases, that kind of puts the brakes on a fire and it might reduce in its intensity for that reason. So we usually see a variety of effects of a fire afterwards. And, you know, a lot of people think a 10,000-acre fire has destroyed 10,000 acres worth of trees, but usually it's not the case. Only a third to a quarter of the landscape burn would be totally burned. So a lot of trees and, you know, brush and stuff does survive a fire.
We have a call from April from Manhattan. April, we don't have a lot of time, so can you make the question fairly brief?
I just wanted to know if you think that climate change is causing more wildfires, because I grew up in North Carolina, and every day there was a thunderstorm, and it was really green, and now they have droughts down there a lot.
The climate is changing. El Nino and La Nina are more pronounced these days. Droughts are cumulative. So something's going on climate-wise, starting in about the late 1990s.
Oh, I totally agree with that.
Yeah,
As a matter of fact, one of my ancestors, Benjamin Franklin, thought, noticed climate change.
But he liked lightning because that allowed him to prove electricity can flow. Oh, okay.
Yeah, but there was also an article in the Times about he and a couple other founding fathers noticing climate change, although they hadn't been there that long.
Does Michelle Bachman know about that?
Probably not.
But, gentlemen, you're saying that we are definitely seeing the effects of climate change?
Yeah. Climates do change. I mean, to an extent, it's cyclical. In the 1960s, there was a period of high significant fire activity. It happened again in the late 1970s. Throughout most of the 80s, we were in kind of a down period on fires. And then once we hit the late 1990s, we saw an uptick in fire activity. The last 3 years, we've seen below-average fire seasons, and now in 2011, it's swung back up, and we're in an active period again. So there's always a cycle.
And thank you both so much for being on today's Please Explain. Ken Frederick and Tom Romanello, Bureau of Land Management Fire Specialists at the National Interagency Fire Center in Boise, Idaho.
It's been a pleasure, Leonard.
Thank you, Leonard.